So before we look into chapter 37, I want you to turn to the key verse that summarizes the entire story of Joseph. The entire story. And you will find that key verse over in Genesis chapter 50. Genesis chapter 50 and verse 20. Genesis chapter 50 and verse 20. And this is what that verse says. This is after Jacob's death, and after the father died, the brothers all afraid, now Joseph is really going to let us have it. Now that father's out of the way, he's going to give us what for selling him into slavery and all the misery we put him through. And they were fearful of this. And look at Joseph's answer. We'll start in verse 19. Joseph said to them, "Fear not. For am I instead of God?" And here's the verse. "Although you intended me harm," or evil is the word, "God intended it for good." Though you intended it for evil, God intended it for good. That is the story. That's the key to everything in Joseph's life. That's the key to everything in Yeshua's life. In fact, that's the very message of the cross. You know what the message of the cross is? Whatever is thrown at you, whatever was thrown at Messiah, with an evil intent, God takes it and turns it into good. It's the principle that where sin abounds, grace much more abounds. It's pictured by the ark. I always love this. Whenever I think of that verse, where sin abounds, grace much more abounds, I picture the ark. You know why? Because if you're in the ark, does it really matter how deep the water is underneath you? Does it make any difference whether it's 50 feet or 1,000 feet? It doesn't make any difference. Because where the water, where the flood abounds, the ark more than abounds. It super abounds. And wherever sin abounds, God's grace super abounds. And whatever you do with evil intent towards God, He can turn it to good. And whatever people do to you with evil intent, you can either kind of shrink up, pull your head in, get mad, get angry, start fuming, or you can trust God that He will turn it to good. And you know, most of you gave your lives to the Lord because you're miserable, right? I was miserable, and I finally got tired of running from God, and I surrendered. And but without that misery, would I have ever surrendered? And so the things that come into your life, you have to remember this, the spiritual principle. The problem's the solution. What's the problem in your life? In that problem is not just the solution to the problem, but a solution for life itself. Your enemies are God's messengers in your lives. The pain and the sorrow is God's message in your life. And as hard as that is to believe, that is the principle of the cross. And wherever sin abounds, whether it's your sin or someone's toward you, God's grace superabounds. Can you just have the faith to believe that and the eyes to see it? That's the question. But think of Messiah, the greatest sin ever committed in the history of man, or ever will be committed, was the execution of God's only Son, the Word made flesh, the perfect one. Nothing worse ever happened in history. Nothing compares with that. And yet, that's the most wonderful and blessed event in history. You follow what I'm saying? That's the principle of the cross. That's the principle of the story of Joseph. Joseph says, "You meant it for evil. You had evil intent in your heart. But God used all your evil toward me and turned it into good, and it resulted in your salvation. Because if you hadn't have done what you did, you would have not have survived the 7 years of famine." You see? Now, shall we sin that grace may abound, Paul asks? God forbid. Of course not. But the thing is, God's goodness is so much greater than our sin. And Yeshua's act on the cross is so much more powerful than Adam's act in the garden. There's no comparison between the two. No comparison whatsoever. Now, as we go through the story of Joseph, We're going to be adding to this list of things. And these are the items I want to try to cover in part of chapter 37. Because there's no individual in the entire Bible whose life parallels that of a Messiah more than Joseph's. Okay? And we talked about this quite a bit a couple weeks ago, and you might want to get that teaching if you weren't here, and because it introduces this whole story of Joseph and the amazing things that the rabbis say about Joseph and their comparison of him to Messiah. But we're going to find that Joseph and Messiah both were shepherds. Messiah calls himself the Good Shepherd, and we see that Joseph is a shepherd. Both of them were mediators. Yeshua is a mediator still, of course. Both beloved of the Father. Both were raised with sons of weakness. We'll see what that means in a moment. Both were called sons of wisdom. They were wise from a very early age. Both were firstborn. Now, we talked about this last time. You think, wait a minute, Joseph was the 11th born. How do you figure he's firstborn? And I want to review that just very quickly. Remember that Joseph was born of Rachel. He was Rachel's first son. And Rachel's the one that Jacob wanted to marry. And when he worked 7 years for Rachel, and they had the wedding, and she had a veil over her face, and they went into the honeymoon tent, when he woke up in the morning, he found out he'd been cheated. And it wasn't Rachel, it was her sister Leah that had been substituted for her. And so he got cheated into marrying Leah, who had 6 children, and her handmaid had 2. Rachel's handmaid had 2. But the firstborn, the one born of Jacob's true love, the one he intended to marry that first wedding night, was Rachel. Her firstborn was Joseph. So spiritually speaking, Joseph was truly the firstborn of Jacob. And he's treated as the firstborn. Both were hated without a cause. This in Hebrew is called sinat chinam. Sinat chinam. It's an amazing story in the Talmud. The rabbis are talking about the destruction of Solomon's temple, and then they're talking about the destruction of Herod's temple. Why was the one destroyed, and why was the other destroyed? And you know the reason they give for the destruction of that temple? Sinat chinam, hatred without a cause. And Yeshua says, they hated me without a cause. And the rabbis don't realize it, but they're absolutely right. It was because of hatred without a cause. In fact, that word kinam comes from the word kin, grace. It's gracious hatred. It's unmerited hatred. It's hatred that is given freely without any cause. So, sinat kinam is what they gave to Messiah. They hated him without a cause. And sure enough, according to the Talmud, Herod's temple is destroyed because of hatred without a cause. So we're going to see that both Joseph reflects a physical and a spiritual reign, and we know that Yeshua reigns physically and spiritually. So we're going to go through this list, and each week we'll add to this. Well, let's jump right in, chapter 37. It says, Jacob settled in the land of his father's sojournings in the land of Canaan. These are the chronicles of Jacob. Joseph, at the age of 17 years, was a shepherd with his brothers by the flock. You know, the way the Hebrew is set up there, you could also translate it this way. Joseph shepherded his brothers. Isn't that interesting? Hebrew is funny that way. It always allows us to see another level of meaning and another level of meaning. Remember that time is something that's our limitation. We are stuck in this flow of time, but God isn't. And so when he revealed these words to Moses to be written down, to God, from where his stand is, time exists in him, the story's done. I mean, the end and the beginning are right there. It's all together in one contained event to him. So he can easily write the end into the beginning of the story. And he had Messiah in mind the entire time that these events unfolded in the life of Joseph. And the way he had it recorded was that Joseph was a shepherd with his brothers, or you can read it, Joseph shepherded his brothers. And isn't that what Messiah came to do? The good shepherd, to shepherd his brothers? But he was a youth with the sons of Bilhah. You know what Bilhah means? Bilhah means weakness. He was a youth with the sons of weakness. And it says, and the sons of Zilpah. Well, the name Zilpah almost means the same thing as Bilhah. Zilpah means dripping or dropping or leaking. Which makes you wonder what her, what she's like as a baby that her parents would name her that. But Bilhah and Zilpah both show weakness, just a loss of life, things just leaking out. And Joseph shepherded his brothers, and these particular ones, the brothers of weakness, the brothers of loss. And that's a picture of Messiah. You know, there was this prophecy in the Talmud, this ancient prophecy that, finally was recorded in the Talmud, that when Messiah comes, he would either come to an utterly righteous generation or to an utterly wicked generation. And Messiah himself proclaimed the generation that he came to as utterly wicked. He called it a wicked generation several times. And I believe, this is my opinion, I believe that when he returns and he descends on the Mount of Olives in Israel, he will come to a righteous generation. I think God is doing marvelous things in the hearts of the Jewish people. He's calling his people back to Israel. There are over 100,000 a year returned to Israel. Israel is up over 5 million people now. For a long time, there were more Jews in New York than in Israel. That's not the case anymore. People are going back to Israel and they don't even know why. They can't even explain why they feel called to go back. And God's doing a work among the people in Israel. He's preparing them for their Messiah. And I just believe, it's just my opinion now, and from hints and gleamers I see in the prophecies, that when Messiah returns, it's going to be to prepared hearts. They're going to say, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And then it says, and Joseph would bring evil reports to their father. Well, you know, this always bothered me, because I always had seen so many parallels between Joseph and Messiah. But then you come to this one, and it sounds like, well, he's an accuser of the brethren, and that's not Messiah. That's Satan. Satan, the accuser of the brethren. Was Joseph an accuser of the brethren? How do you get around this? He brought evil reports. And the word is evil there. He brought evil reports to his father. He spent time shepherding with his brothers. He'd come back to dad and says, Dad, these kids' ears, they're a mess. And he would share the things they were involved in. Of course, the rabbis try to comment on what the particular sins were, but we're not concerned with that this morning. You know, in Revelation 12:10, this is what it says about Satan. It says, then I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation, the power, and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah have come. For the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, he who accuses them before our God day and night. I want to take a moment and talk about Satan and what the accuser of the brethren is, and then come back to Joseph. Because I think there's a real lesson to be learned about what the Word tells us about Satan. Think about this for a moment. For Satan to be the accuser of the brethren, Satan has to know a few things. First of all, he's got to know right from wrong. Right? If I accuse Gunter here of something wrong that he did, and I go tell his daddy, Gunter, he did this and he did this and he did this. I'm going to accuse him of bad things he did, right? Not good things, bad things. Satan knows right from wrong. And he goes before the Father day and night, and he's doing this now. He hasn't been cast out of heaven yet. That's a fallacy when we're taught that Satan's been cast out of heaven. He hasn't yet. That day is still coming. It happens in Revelation 12. But right now, he's accusing us before the Father day and night. And he's accusing you of the wrong things you do. What's interesting, there are a number of believers I've met, and you've met, that think it's their holy calling to be an accuser of the brethren. They pride themselves in their ability to find flaws in things, and they're genuine flaws. And they think this is great spiritual insight. I'm not so sure it is. I think it's satanic insight. Now, don't get me wrong. There, we need to be alert, and we need to be sensitive to hidden dangers and things. Definitely. We must practice discernment. We must be a discerning people to see the hidden dangers and the things around us when they're there. But to take a person or whatever it is and pride yourself, I found this flaw and that thing was wrong and there's this doctrinal issue and oh, they shouldn't have said that and that word shouldn't have been used. What good is that? If you're like that, I've got news for you. That thing you're doing, that's a flaw. Why don't you work on that? Why don't you work on that? But don't pride yourself on being able to see every flaw in the things around you. It's really not that tough. And it's not the kind of thing Messiah did. I want you to think about this for a moment. Read through the Gospels. Do a quick reading through the Gospels, all four. You can take it in a week. You can just, in your morning time, just read as many chapters as you can. Go straight through the Gospels and do this. Look for all the times Yeshua pointed out error in the life of someone else. And the second thing was, did the person come to him or did Yeshua go to them first? You're going to find a very, very rare thing that Yeshua goes to them. In fact, I'm not sure it's even there at all. You're going to find a very rare thing that he points out errors in other people, points out sins in them. He does occasionally, but it's a very rare thing. The ones he really does it with are the hypocrites, the religious leaders, the ones who prided themselves on being the spiritual examples. Those are the ones he really cut loose on. But Messiah was perfect. The Gospels tell us that he saw what was in the heart of a man, which means he saw every single flaw in every single person. Let that sink in for a moment. He was intimately aware of every flaw in every person, whether visible or hidden away. He saw every flaw, everyone. And yet, he really didn't talk about it that much. You want a wonderful example? John chapter 4, where he meets the woman at the well. Here was a sinful woman. And Yeshua's at the well, his disciples go into town to buy some food, and he's sitting there. And this woman comes along by herself. And he strikes up a conversation with her. And he doesn't accuse her of any sin, so she's a sinful woman. And he has a very deep conversation with her, deeper than the one in the chapter before with Nicodemus, a member of the Sanhedrin. He's talking to this woman, the Samaritan woman. And then he says, well, go and call your husband. And she says, well, I don't have a husband. And he says, well said. That's absolutely true. You've had five husbands, and the one you're living with now you're not married to. So you gave me a good answer. And what's so amazing about this, even in her dodge of his question, he made it aware to her, I know all about you, but I'm not condemning you. And then after the conversation is over, she runs into town. She leaves her water pot. She runs into town. And what does she tell the people of the town? Come and hear a man who told me everything I've done. Oh, wait a minute. You look at it. He didn't tell her what she had done. Why did she say that? It's because he had told her everything she had done. He'd revealed to her all of her shortcomings without having to say a word to her about them. The fact that she knew, that he knew everything wrong with her, and yet did not condemn her, allowed her to see her own faults and to realize, he loves me anyway. This one who is, I know, the Messiah. She's the only one who he openly comes out to and says, I am the Messiah. Because she says, well, when Messiah comes, he'll reveal all these things. He says, the one speaking to you now is he. That's the only person he does that to. The Samaritan woman, the lowliest of the low. The one who's so filled with faults. And yet he doesn't accuse her. Doesn't lay them all on display for her and say, get on your knees and repent now or you're going to hell. He just let her know, I know all about you. And look, I'm talking with you. I love you. I accept you. And I want to give you living water. And that allowed her to see herself in the light of his grace and goodness. Can we be more like that? You know, I used to think I had the ministry of accusation. I didn't call it that. I look back at it now and I realize that's what I pretty much how I operated. It was my job to go around and point out everybody's faults. And I was good at it and I enjoyed it. And I was empowered to do this. You know what? Those days are gone with me. I just don't dig that anymore. I rather catch people being good. Because as I began to realize, this is what Satan does. He knows right from wrong. And he's always pointing out the wrong. Always accusing. Well, I'm not to be like him. I'm not a disciple of Satan. I'm to be a disciple of Messiah. And as I read through the Gospels, it's hard to even find a place where Messiah puts his finger in somebody's face and says, you're a sinner. The only ones I see him really doing that with, again, are the religious leaders, the hypocrites. Those are the ones he cuts loose on. So what are we to make of this about Joseph? I mean, he's supposed to be a picture of Messiah, and yet he's taking these accusations, these evil reports, rather, to the Father. Well, let's look at a couple things. First of all, he didn't take the evil reports to the neighbors. And he didn't take the evil reports to the brothers and say, you sinners, you're all wrong, you should be doing this, you're all messed up. He took them to the Father because his Father was the only one with the authority and had the position to do something about it. He took them to the Father. He was a mediator. He was a mediator. And so he took them to the Father. Also, an interesting thing is this. The word that's used there for evil report is the word divatam. Divatam. And it says here in the scriptures that he brought the divatam to the Father. He did not spread the evil reports to the others. Because in Numbers and in Proverbs, Proverbs 10:18 says that anyone who spreads a dibah is a fool. And Joseph didn't do that. He took what he saw. He couldn't say he didn't see what he saw. And when you see sin in the life of another, you can't just close your eyes and say, well, I didn't see that. You saw it. And you should be able to recognize sin when you see it. The question is, what do you do with it now? Right? I mean, Yeshua tells us, you will recognize false prophets by their fruit. We need to recognize false prophets, false teachers. We need to recognize wolves in sheep's clothing. How? You recognize them, you'll identify them by their fruit. And if you can't tell them by their fruit, something's wrong. Now, when you identify one, what you do with that information, this is what determines whether you're stepping out of line or you're doing the right thing. Do you spread the evil report? Or do you take it to the Father? Do you take it to maybe the leaders in the congregation, the ones who are in a position to actually deal with it and do something about it? If you spread it, you're a fool, according to Scripture. If you spread the evil report to people who are not part of the problem or part of the solution, you're a fool. And you're practicing satanic principles. If you take it to the Father, then you're practicing godly principles. If you take it to the individual who lovingly and graciously can help restore this individual, you're acting according to godly principles. And if you are one who is spiritual, Messiah says, take it to them. You know, we have to be very, very careful with these things. There is such a fine line between acting like Messiah and acting like Satan, but it's a line, nevertheless. We need to be very careful. We never, ever cross that line. Why does Satan accuse us? Why does he get so upset with us? Why, you'd think we'd be beneath contempt to him. Why does he care about us so much that he wants to accuse us before God's throne day and night? I want you to turn to a passage in Isaiah 14. Isaiah 14. Isaiah chapter 14. And we're going to read four verses, 13, 14, 15, 16. Now, this prophecy is against one of the kings of Babylon, and it refers to Lucifer. Okay? But we realize that though Isaiah's prophecy is against this king, we also realize God never does one thing at a time. He always does multiple things at a time. So while Isaiah is prophesying against this king, God at the same time is prophesying, revealing things about Satan himself. He does this all the time. God never does one thing at a time. Everything he speaks is on multiple levels. It's like the psalmist writes. He says, one thing God spoke, two things I heard. And he probably could have said three things, four things, five things, because every word of God is multi-layered. God's word is like music, and it's in counterpoint with three and four and five and six-part harmony. It's got all these levels and layers to it. There's so many things going on, and it's so utterly beautiful. So, here we are. All that was just to give you time to turn to it, so I'm assuming you're there by now. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the cloud. That's singular. I will make myself like Elyon, like the Most High. Nevertheless, this is what God says, nevertheless you will be thrown down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. Those who see you will gaze at you, they will ponder over you, saying, is this the guy who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms? This? Now this picture of Satan, these words addressed to Satan, I refer to as Satan's five I wills. Do you see what they were? I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the cloud. I will make myself like the Most High. Five boasts, five I wills of Satan. I'm going to show you why Satan is a very unhappy camper, why he is so angry. He's got to be the most frustrated creature in the universe. Because these five things he says, I will do, these five things he's determined to do, guess what? For the person who does not pursue these five things, but pursues service to God, God gives all five of these things to that individual. That has got to make Satan mad as Sheol. He says, I will ascend into heaven. Now, I already said he's already there accusing God before his throne day and night. But you have to understand that heaven is a much more complex place than we tend to think. And even within heaven, before God's throne room, there are levels and levels and levels of depth and of holiness. But he wants to ascend to the very heights. But when we look at John 14, verses 2 through 5, Messiah says, in my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you, for I go to prepare a place for you. If I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Isn't that wonderful? So the thing Satan is striving for, Messiah gives to his followers freely. Satan says, I will raise my throne above the stars of God. When you see stars of God in the scriptures, it's code word for the angels. The angels. And Satan says, I'm going to rule over all the angelic beings. Well, 2 Corinthians 6:3, Paul is quoting a very ancient mystical script. What's the word we're looking for? Manuscript, the writing. And it says, Paul says, do you not know that we will judge angels, will judge the stars of God? How much more matters of this life? Think about that. We who are created a little below the angels, God is going to make their judges. That's an amazing thought. Satan says, I will sit on the mount of assembly in the north, in the recesses of the north. Now, this is a little odd because this word north can be translated a few ways. It can mean north. In Hebrew, the word north is zaphon. And zaphon means hidden. So it can mean that I'm going to sit in the assembly of the hidden, behind sight. In other words, like the Holy of Holies, that's the hidden place. That's the secret place. It also could just simply mean the word zaphon. In Babylonian mythology, zaphon is the name of the place where the gods reside. And even in one of the Psalms refers to Zaphon. And this is very well known. Zaphon is a name of a place in Babylonian mythology where the gods reside. So in this, in context of this prophecy against this king of Babylon, this would make sense as well. But in the psalm where it refers to Zaphon, I should have written down the reference, he talks about Mount Zion, and then to the north of that is the Temple Mount, okay? Directly north of where the king's house stood, where the palace was, right north of that is the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount is not Mount Zion, by the way. Mount Zion is just to the south, where the palace was. But to the north of that is where the temple is. So, however we translate this, it's all given us the message. He wants to sit in the holiest of places, the place of control, the very center of the universe. He wants to be in charge. All right. Ephesians 2:6, a wonderful passage. In Ephesians 2:6, Paul tells us that Messiah has raised us up with him and seated us with him in heavenly places. Isn't that wonderful? Seated us with him. Where does he sit? On his throne. And it says, we are seated with him in heavenly places. Satan says, I will ascend above the heights of the cloud. And actually, the word cloud, that's a typo. It should be, it's singular. What does it mean, the cloud? Well, if you were in Israel, in Jerusalem, at the time of the prophecy, the cloud was the cloud of glory that stood over the tabernacle and then over the temple. And also referred to the cloud of smoke that went straight up from the altar. These clouds were to show that God's Shekinah dwelt there and is also the path pointing up directly to the spiritual realm. And he says, I'm going to dwell above that. In other words, not just in the temple, but everything the temple points to, I'm going to be above that. Everything about the temple is going to be worship of me. 1 Thessalonians 4:17, Paul tells us that we who are alive and remain will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we shall always be with the Lord, so that where he is, we'll be also, right? And then the fifth I will make myself like Elyon, like the Most High. God uses the name Elyon to refer to the one who possesses heaven and earth. Elyon is always used to refer to the lofty one who possesses all of heaven and earth. And Satan says, I'm going to make myself like that. But 1 John 3:2 comes along and says, Beloved, now are we the children of God. It has not yet appeared what we shall be. But we know that when he appears, we will be like him because we will see him just as he is. You get the picture? The five things Satan strives to accomplish, he will be denied. He will be cast down to Sheol. It's just the very opposite of this. Then all the peoples of the earth will look at him saying, that's all he is? That? That was the thing I was afraid of? This is the one that shook kingdoms, made the earth tremble, made the earth a wilderness? That? Hoi fei, you know? And people who look at us now and says, I want to be like that? You spend your Saturdays in synagogue? You pray? You give 10% of your money away to who? Ah, you know? I don't want to be like that. But then when we revealed, my goodness, what a wonderful day. The whole creation groans awaiting the revelation of the children of God. What a day that is to live for. You know what I'm saying? So Satan's an angry person. He's an angry person. But what's interesting, you have to remember that before the throne of God, he's speaking the truth. I came across this this quote by William Blake, the great Christian mystic. He was a very oddball guy, but he did say some good stuff. He said, a truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent. Isn't that the truth? A truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent. Makes me think of people. You ever had people come to you and they pride themselves on being brutally honest? I find that most of the time, people who are brutally honest relish the brutality a lot more than the honesty. You know? Again, I speak from experience. So, is Joseph an accuser of the brethren? because he brought these evil reports. No, he was a mediator, because he did not spread the ill reports. He took them to his father. He spoke truth out of a heart of love, not of accusation, like you need to punish them, you need to beat them, you need to put them down. But Father, what can we do to help them? It's a completely different MO from Satan. Well, let's move on a bit further. That's what we're here for. So let's get through some more of chapter 37. And it says in verse 3, now Israel loved Joseph. Well, wait a minute. Israel. Most of the time, Jacob is called Jacob, even though his name had been changed to Israel. Most of the time, he's called Jacob. In fact, back up in verse 1, Jacob settled in the land of his father's sojournings. But we come to this verse, in verse 3, it goes to his name Israel, Prince of God. It says, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons since he was a child of his old age. Rabbi Hirsch, who was not a believer, but Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, this brilliant, brilliant rabbi, a Torah genius, he said, Israel, not Jacob, regarded Joseph as the most excellent of his sons. Let me read that part again. Israel, not Jacob, regarded Joseph as the most excellent of his sons, for he saw himself living on in Joseph. In Joseph he saw the heir to all his spiritual attainments. That's a beautiful verse of praise, words of praise. And then it says he was a child of his old age. He was a ben zakein. Zakein means an old person. But you know, if you have a art scroll Chumash, or a Chumash that has the Aramaic next to the Hebrew, you got the Hebrew over here, then right next to it you got this narrow column of Aramaic. This ancient Aramaic translation translates that a bit differently. In the Aramaic it says, Bar Chacham Hu, a son of wisdom was he. Hebrew, son of his old age, in the Aramaic, they translate it as a son of wisdom. Why did they do that? It's because in Hebrew thought, Hebraic thought, an old person, a zakein, is a person of wisdom. In fact, there's a play on words, there's an ancient play on words that the word zakein, it's only three letters in Hebrew. In English it would be Z, K, and N. And they say these three letters stand for Ze, Kana, Chokhma. This one has acquired wisdom. And you know, this is one of the reasons the Torah commands us. When we see an older person, one with white hair, we rise and stand when they enter the room. So that's a good commandment to fulfill. And this is one, parents, you should teach your children that when they see an elderly person, they do the very opposite thing that they pick up from the world. In the world, you want to honor the young and the strong and the athletic. But in the Torah mindset, you honor the old. Because they've been things you probably can only dream about. And they've survived to tell about it. And you stand in honor of them. They've earned the right for you to stand before them. Because they've acquired wisdom that you're just beginning to scratch the surface on. We need to train our children to do this. Especially as I get older and my hair is starting to turn gray. I'm looking forward to all the young people just shooting up out of their seat. No, I'm kidding. One thing more I want to say about Satan. Because as I was pondering these things, I was thinking that especially in the faith prosperity movement, we find people doing what Satan is doing. Satan says, I will do this, I will do this, I will do this, I will do this. And all those five things he said he will do are things that God was doing. God had done. In other words, Satan wanted to be like God. We should want to be like God. Right? So what's the difference between us and Satan? It's this. Satan wanted to imitate God's authority and power. That should never, ever be our desire. In fact, everything in witchcraft, in the occult, and in Satanism is always a grab for power. Always. You talk to anyone who's practicing the occult, practicing witchcraft, and you have a short conversation with them. It only takes a short conversation, and you discuss their motives. You'll always find at the heart of their motives power. And when you find people in the faith prosperity movement, you find the same thing. I said before, and I say it now with even more conviction than I ever have before, that there is a lot of occult practice in a lot of churches, messianic and otherwise. And when you see churches and messianic congregations always trying to enter an altered state of consciousness, trying to manipulate God to do their will, to give them the things that they think they deserve and they want, they need to claim it and twist God's arm and use His words against Him to make Him and squeeze Him and give out the things that they want, that's no different, absolutely no different from what's taking place in the occult. Except it's not as honest as the occult. At least the occult does not dress itself up in Christian garb. So in many ways, it's even worse. Be very cautious when you're sitting in a place and they're telling you, get this from God, and you pray this, we're going to claim this, we're going to storm the throne room, and you know, and we speak it out in faith, and God's got to do it. You just get up and run. You'd be better off in a coven. Because at least there you know where you're at, and it's not attractive. You hear what I'm saying? We are not to try to imitate God's authority and His power. We are to imitate His character. That's called holiness. It's called humility. That's a word we need to learn. Because humility and smallness are the secret to power and spiritual authority. Humility and smallness. Now, humility is not thinking bad and lowly of yourself. It's just not thinking of yourself at all. That's what it is. You got it? And if we can just practice that, the heavens will open up to us. We need to imitate God's character, His joy. Imitate His wisdom. Learn that. And imitate His holiness, His character. Those are the things we should be striving to align our lives with. And it starts with obedience to His Word. That's your first act of humility. To acknowledge God knows better than me. And though I understand why this is commanded, it comes from Him to me. I'm going to start doing it. Maybe I'll understand later. That's true wisdom. Humility is the beginning of wisdom. Fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. Both of those are quotes from the Scriptures. Humility and fear of God. But people who want to storm the gates of heaven to get what they want, I don't see any fear of God in that. None at all. Okay, I got off onto a little rabbi trail there. Let's finish with one more thing. It says in verse 3, and He made him a fine... And in Hebrew, it's ketonet pasim. The ketonet part we understand. That means a tunic. It's the pasim part that was translated all over the place. Nobody can quite figure out exactly how to translate that word pasim. There's what it looks like in Hebrew. Ketonet, pasim. The adjective comes after the noun. Ketonet means tunic, pasim. Not sure. Some people translate it multicolored. Some people translate it royal. Some translate it embroidered. Some translate it fringed. Did I say long? And Rabbi Nachmanides says it was striped. So, what is it? We don't know. So why does God give us words in His Torah, but He doesn't allow the true definition of that word to be passed down to us as well? It's because He wants us to look beyond that. He wants us to look deeper into the Word. I'm going to give you some quotes from what's called the Midrash Rabbah. I've used that term a lot of times, so to make sure you understand what that is. Midrash means search or study. Because when you study, you're searching into something. Rabbah means great. All right? So the Midrash Rabbah is the great studies, the great and ancient Bible studies. And these were all collected for us. They were all written down. They were memorized by the ancients. Yeshua knew all of these things in Midrash Rabbah, but praise God, they were finally written down for us. And they're filled with brilliance and insight. Just amazing things, amazing things. For example, Paul often refers to the Midrash Rabbah. And when he's teaching, he refers to a number of things that are found only there. For example, the Midrash Rabbah, a little rabbi tree, I'll make this a fast one. The Midrash Rabbah tells us that the rock that Moses struck and gave forth the water, that it rolled through the wilderness for the 40 years and produced water for them all that time. The same rock. You think, well, that's not in the Bible. Oh, yeah, it is. It's in 1 Corinthians 10, where Paul says, "And the rock that followed them was Messiah." Okay? And also in Timothy, he talks about Jannes and Jambres, the two magicians in Egypt. Guess what? Their Bible, their names aren't found anywhere in the Bible. You go to the Midrash Rabbah, and he gives us all this detail about Jannes and Jambres, these Egyptians, these magicians. You see, reading the Bible, they're the first ones to tell Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. We need to listen to this prophet. This is God's hand bringing these plagues. They sound like good guys, basically. They were the first ones to repent from among the Egyptians. But you go to the Midrash Rabbah, it tells us that when the Israelites came out of Egypt, they came to Mount Sinai. Moses goes on top to receive the Torah. He's up there for 40 days and nights. They're getting bored. And finally they say, let's make gods to lead us and we'll go back to Egypt. And then they you know how that all turned out, the golden calf and all that. Well, in the Midrash Rabbah says the two that instigated that whole event were Jannes and Jambres. There's their names. Now, with that background, you go to Timothy. Paul is saying, in the last days, there will be those who will, and then he goes on to talk about how they'll lead us astray because Messiah's return seems delayed. It talks about these people of folly, like Jannes and Jambres, who revolted, who withstood Moses, who stood against him. Well, you know, with the Midrash Rabbah, that whole passage opens up to us. It's amazing. Anyways, we're in Genesis, though, aren't we? So I'm going to give you some quotes in the Midrash Rabbah about this word pasim. They're wonderful. They're wonderful words. Now, the word pasim is four letters in Hebrew. Pe, Samek, Yud, Mem. It's like P, S, Y, or I, and then the letter M. So in English, it would be something like this. The vowel is not, there are no vowels in Hebrew, but it's pronounced pasim. So I make the A small. And so the Midrash Rabbah says, well, these four letters represent the four owners of Joseph. Potiphar owned Joseph. The Socharim owned Joseph. These are the merchants. The Ishmaelites owned Joseph. And the Midianites owned Joseph. As you read a little bit later in the chapter, or later in the account, you'll find that his brothers sold him to this group, who sold him to that group, and to that group, and finally Potiphar wound up with him. And look what it spells, Pasim. So they say Pasim is one of the secret things about that, or these are the people who owned Joseph. Now one of the things about Joseph is this, he's like Messiah in this regard. You can do with Messiah whatever you want. You can ignore him, you can worship him, you can obey him, you can spit on him, you can crucify him, you can curse him, you can deny you ever knew him, you can follow him. You can do with him whatever you want. God allows you to do with Messiah whatever you want. You can do with the Torah whatever you want. Anything you want, you can do it. People ask me, well, what do I have to do? I say, anything, nothing. God will let you do anything you want. The question is, what do you want to do? Do you want to follow him? All right, here's the place to start. You want to serve him? You want to be his disciple? God's not going to make you do anything in this life. You do what you want. And you can do with Messiah whatever you want. But your eternal destiny is determined by what you do with him. So to be wise what we do with him. Joseph, you know, they just passed him from hand to hand to hand. And then when they used him and then they were done with him, they passed him on to somebody else. It's pretty amazing to think about it. But even in all of that, God's hands at work and God elevated him up to be the Savior of the world. This is interesting. In the Midrash Rabbah, it says it is called Pasim because they cast lots over it. And the word for lots is the word hafisu, which comes from the root for Pasim. Isn't that interesting? Because who else had their robe taken and lots cast over it? Yeshua. Now remember, this is an ancient Bible study that precedes the birth of Yeshua. And they said, Joseph's coat, his brothers cast lots over it to see which one who would take it and then present it to Jacob. And there is Yeshua, who also is hated by his brothers, cast aside, and they cast lots over his coat as well. What an amazing parallels. Now Ramban, who's Rabbi Moses ben Nachmanides, I love the way they shorten names. They take the initials of the person's names, put it together, and come up with things like Rambam and Rashi and all these things. So my name would be Legal. LGL, legal. So it's kind of fun. But he says that the word pasi means stripes. And again, who is striped and pierced for our transgressions? Messiah. But this one's my favorite. Why was it, this is a quote, why was it they hated him? Because he divided the sea before them. Pasim indicating pas yam, dividing the sea. You see, you take that word pasim and you cut it in two. Pe samek spells to divide. Yad mem spells yam, sea. Divided the sea. This is an incredible insight. Can you wrap your mind around this? They said, this coat, because according to the scriptures, it says he made them his wonderful coat and his brothers hated him. His brothers saw that it was he whom their father loved most of all his brothers, so they hated him. When they saw Jacob give this coat to Joseph, they became jealous and they hated him. This is the thing that started the whole ball rolling. Because they hated him, they sold him to these traitors who sold him to Potiphar, who then had him put in prison, and then eventually Pharaoh elevates him. The famine comes, the brothers come in, then Jacob comes down and lives with them. The years go by, they become slaves in Egypt, and then eventually God raises up Moses and brings him out and through the parted sea, all because of the coat. It's God's sovereignty painted all over this coat. Pasim to me represents that Joseph is one who lived totally and completely under God's sovereignty. And no matter how something was meant for evil, even though the coat was taken, dipped in blood, and presented to the father as proof of his death, God used it to lead a whole nation across the Red Sea because of the Pasim. The splitting of the Red Sea was woven right into that coat. Little things become big things in the hand of God. It's a wonderful thing to look at. Their hatred of him is what eventually became the trigger that brought their deliverance later on. That's an incredible thing to think about. Yes, Dale. Gives me a chance to get a gulp of water here.
It seems ironic that Joseph, who is so well associated with the coat, the clothing, and it's kind of part of his moniker, that he was willing to throw off his command and run away from 6 seconds.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Good point. We'll be getting to that one later. Yeah, he threw aside his tunic, stepped out of it when Potiphar's wife was trying to seduce him. Yeah. This is the last thing. Oh, it's time to eat. This is the last thing we're going to do. I want you to notice this is a powerful thing. It says in chapter 37, verse 4, they hated him. This is because of their father's favor, Jacob giving this coat to Joseph. And then in chapter 37, verse 5, it says, they gated him. That should be hated. Sorry for the typo. They hated him even more. And this is due to Joseph's words about his dreams. But this is the thing that stood out to me. I'd never noticed before. They start talking about Joseph. And in verse 8, listen to what it says. His brothers said to him, His brother said to him, Joseph hasn't done any more now, but his brother said to him, would you then reign over us? Would you then dominate us? And they hated him even more. In other words, they hated him even more due to their own words. This stood out to me. I'd never thought about this before. We've all hated people before. But you know what? How to feed that hatred? Start talking about them, and you'll hate them more. When you talk about those you hate, your hatred for them will grow, and you will actually distance yourself further and further from God. We need to be very careful with our words. Our words can feed our hate for somebody. And on the flip side, your words can cause you to love someone more. You need to be careful how we speak. You need to be careful. Our time is gone. I apologize for going over, but it went fast for me. So let's have a word of prayer, and then we'll have the blessing over the bread and cup. Father, thank you for this time together. Thank you for your wonderful words of life. And Lord, as we continue to look at the life of Joseph, I pray we would see the life of Messiah in clear and clear detail. And mixed in and woven into all of this, may we see ourselves. May we see you. May we see your principles, and may you build wisdom into our lives. And we'll give you praise for this in the precious name of our Messiah, Yeshua. Amen.